You're gonna agree. I'll just be here.
For my film. No, I like red.
Well, firstly, I just want to say what a pleasure it is to be able to see all these works together in such an amazing screening environment. I think we're all kind of on a particular frequency now at this point.
It was a bright projection.
Yeah, it was great. It was just wonderful. I'm just such a fan of your work. I'm just excited to be here and talking to you.
Yeah, I'm happy to finally get to talk to you for the first time in real life, too. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, so we have... Let me just make sure. Oh, we've got a little bit of time. Okay. 15:02, right?
Yes.
Okay. Excellent. So I just wanted to start off because I'm always struck in watching your work about with the sort of the moiréed mesh of pixelating, you know, pulsating pixels that kind of create these brilliant spatial transitions and a real surprising and kind of pleasurable way of navigating space and the way that, you know, it's sort of almost like an 8-bit, but also 3D virtual camera at the same time. So I wondered if you could, and it's very sort of particular and specific to your work, so I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about how you kind of found this aesthetic and how you got there.
My mind first goes to is when I was studying in university, my animation professor, I didn't study animation formally, but there was a professor there who was an animator named James Dusing, and he, I think his work is amazing. He's a really inspiring person to me. And one of the things that he would say in talking about animation in reference to his work, but I think perhaps more largely, like one of the great things that animation does or compositing or anything that we want to say is in this realm of motion graphics or whatever, is that we're not bound to, when we're putting films together, to leveraging the hard cut. We're also not bound to like a single take because those frames are all really fluid, right? And so what you'll see in a lot of Jim's work is that, especially his earlier stuff, that they're not really hard cuts. The scenes transition into each other, and that was something that when I started getting into animation was really exciting to me. And so, I mean, I guess it's interesting / funny to call this a retrospective because really this is just the work that I've been making for the past 5 years. Before I was making this work, a lot of the work I made lived under the banner of Hooliganship, which was a band and a collaborative project with my friend Christopher Dolgaris, who was the sound designer for Alone with the Moon, the first film that we watched. And the work that we made at that point looked formally, in some ways, similar. It had this maximalist aesthetic, but it was concerned with really different things. It was like everything all of the time. It was this real collage aesthetic. I guess when for a variety of different reasons, my life shifted gears, I wasn't really interested in appropriation or collage or like external cultural reference points as the material for own work. And so, I mean, in a way, it's interesting to sit here with all of you guys to watch this retrospective, because especially at the beginning, this work is really, I was going to therapy a lot, and there's this real, like, for the first time in my life, I was using my art practice to just explore a solely interior space, and I wasn't much concerned with, like, an audience for it, and stuff like that. But part of that was abandoning this precept that I wanted to try to use every color all the time, and just to like at the time when I was making work under Hooliganship, it was sort of this philosophy to like antagonize against this garbage that I grew up consuming, and still, you know, all the, you know,
very vibrant colors most of the time.
Yeah, but as like a strategy to fight against, like whenever I log onto the internet or my phone, there's this. I know there's apps you can use, or I think it's actually built into my iPhone. I can make it grayscale if I want. But, like, you know, it was just, like, a strategy to kind of push against that, like, pay attention, like, being in Times Square or whatever. And so when I started wanting to explore, like, a different sensibility, I just was like, okay, I'm abandoning color. I want to go into black and white, in part because I saw through, I mean, I guess there's a tradition of... like, I guess you can think about Bridget Riley, an op art painter, right? There's a way to still achieve a similar sensibility that this maximalist being in Times Square, having floaters burned into your eyes because of the LEDs or this light that's shooting at me. You know, there's a way to do that that's actually just tethered to the way that our biology functions, and our eyes have their own ways of like producing color, actually.
Yeah.
And so that led me down this path of just like exploring black and white. And as I first got into that, I guess the way that I got into that was in part maybe because I was doing a lot of therapy and Freudian therapy to make matters worse. I was like, okay, I'm going to go back to the first tool that I ever used to make digital artwork, which was an old Mac computer from the mid-90s, and there was a program on that called Mac Paint. One thing that was really cool about Mac Paint, because the monitor that I had was black and white, there were swatches, like in Photoshop or whatever, a lot of digital tools, you have swatches for color, but because it was black and white, that was replaced with different pattern. And you could combine them in really interesting ways, these different fill patterns to create, in a way, like, we can go back to printmaking or whatever. There's lots of different ways to talk about, you know, different strategies to elicit tonal variation and stuff like that. And so really, I mean, we could look at Jim Dusing and the way that I was inspired by that, and I could also, I guess, talk about, you know, my very first computer I ever worked on was an Apple IIe, which was a green and black monitor. And so, like, just thinking about all those impingements and constraints and inspirations, here we are.
Right. Yeah. That absolutely makes sense. I mean, I think especially in a film it's Red Green with the kind of highway.
Green red.
Exactly. Green red. Which I think is great because it's predominantly black and white, but also, but this, you know, this sort of. One of the things about the space, and I really like what you're saying about that the entire screen is alive, and so often in any kind of computer animation we see this very set sense of a sort of a place and a world, and that idea that actually every single pixel is what is actually operating, and it's so alive and in every scene of your work, every frame, you know, I think that's quite striking. So I wanted to ask as well about. So you mentioned that you have done collaborations, and I noticed that a lot of the sound is collaborative, or at least it seems. I'd like for you to speak a little bit about that, because I think the sound is such an important part of the experience of your work.
Yeah, I guess before I talk about sound, because there wasn't a proper credits roll at the end of this, and the first few films that were in the program, I didn't put credits at the end of my films for a long time. I already gave a call out to Christopher Delgaris, who did the sound for Alone with the Moon. The second film we watched, which is Special Effect, Seabat, who is a current collaborator, John Also Bennett, and his bandmate Forrest Christensen made all the music for that. And that came out of a larger project where I also commissioned music from Lucky Dragons, but that was for originally Special Effect. It was this cinema performance where I had lasers and a set, and I would do Lucky Dragons composed the music that I performed with. But then in addition, Special Effect, I actually did a Kickstarter campaign to raise money to finance the commission of 20 different commercial breaks to kind of disrupt that Tarkovskian zone that we inhabit.
There were two of them in that one.
Two like formal commercial breaks. The first was Jacob Chiacci, and the second one was Brandon Blumart. But also throughout, we see these tapestries that are kind of alive with video, and those contained videos by Brenna Murphy and Yoshi Sodioka and Ola Vasilyeva. Those were a bit more like scraps. You know, we were kind of sharing things. They were really generous with their work for that project. In terms of music, because I mentioned Hooliganship earlier, I mean, that was a band, it was a performance project, it was a business, we had a business account even. It was very much a lively relationship, and so our art practice, Christopher, I guess, was much more on the music end of things. I think that's where he would have identified, and me on the visual. But we went back and forth, like, we both composed the music, we both made the animations. And so, I guess, coming out of university in this more formal art training, it just became really logical to allow the process to be a bit more messy. I talked about this a little bit yesterday, but at the time I really thought about the things that we were fabricating, the artwork that we were making, is like a kind of crystal that we were like influencing by balancing all these various forces to kind of like shape that volume, right? And so like music being one of them, animation being one of them, you know, performance and all these other facets at the time. And so I see, while these days, since I moved to New York City from Portland, where I was working with Christopher, I'm not really on the ground making music anymore, but I met John Also Bennett, who I've been collaborating with pretty closely now for for like 5 years. And so we're very much on the same page. And I think because I come from that background, we can have these really great conversations, like even like this morning, we're making a new work together. And so, yeah, I mean, I guess I've always valued the fluidity of these different aspects of making moving image work.
Right, great, yeah. It works beautifully. I think, you know, as the frequency of the sound, it's actually you guys are on the same frequency in terms of the collaboration. Yeah, so I wanted to ask you, I know, as you're mentioning, a lot of these are performance pieces or installations, and I know, obviously, you've edited them down into this sort of cinema format, but I wondered if you could talk, because there are a sort of narrative elements, it seems, that, you know, I'm not sure whether you want to tell us about your process in terms of narrative, how you structure things, but then also how you might edit it into a single channel piece.
Yeah, I mean, it changes all the time, in part because each one of the pieces that we saw today, like their Genesis forms, were all really different. I guess I don't really think of it so much as like editing it down. Okay. Sometimes it feels like editing it up. Sometimes it feels like editing it over, because the cinema is just there's such a different framework here that we get to deal with. And so, yeah, I guess in thinking, I'll talk about pattern language, because that was the last film we watched and the last one that I made. Originally, that piece, I had a 2-month residency in Lower Manhattan at this space called Three Legged Dog. It's an art and technology center. And they gave me a black box theater that was about the size of this room. And the first few days that I moved in there, I hired some friends to help me erect these 4 screens. So basically like a 180-degree projection surface. And I rigged up projectors. They have a grid. And we hung up like, I think, 7 speakers. And so there was this interest in making like an architectural space that mirrored an architectural space with people in it that mirrored people. And to kind of just think about these systems being in Lower Manhattan too. I mean, very much that universe, that reality is like reflected in that work. But the process, like basically for 2 months, I hired a programmer, Mark Fingerhut, to be in that space with me. And we made the work in that space using a game engine called Unity, like a piece of software that's typically used to make video games. And we just kind of carved out the piece for that format and worked with John to make this, like, very much the idea was we wanted people to walk around the room. So there are these kind of like microtonal psychoacoustic pockets where as you moved around, the piece would actually change and the subs were underneath you. So they really like gave you like an anal seizure. It was like really in your body. But we made just a ton of material and I built this kind of algorithmic playback system so that the piece, it had these like iterative variations, but that people would stay in there weirdly for hours. You know, I guess it would kind of hypnotize you perhaps because of that sub bass would just tie you to your seat. But
I'm afraid they might poop.
You know, some of them did. But we generated a ton of material, and the structure for that was very much about this like infinitude and creating these like phasing structures. So like, I mean, you could think about different strategies that minimalist composers could use to create different forms of music composition. But with a film, that I guess it just doesn't feel interesting to be like, let's sit in this room for an hour and get hypnotized. I don't like watching movies that way. I sat on the material for a couple of months and then made a re-edit and had conversations with friends, just kind of looking and thinking to create like a, you know, just like a shape of like pressure and forces to build something that might echo what we think of as narrative structure. But then also could maybe people that aren't familiar with the installation, what that was, to maybe create surprises so that it's not all, you know, you're not all just spilling it out at the front.
Yeah. Yeah, great. It's interesting because it does seem like, I mean, I say narrative nodes, but more kind of a elements of recognition, let's say. And it's interesting to think of how you would re-spatialize it and capture something that was quite complicated and complex in the installation form.
Yeah, and it's always kind of scary. I mean, I'm making a new piece right now that's actually it's going to just run right in Unity, which is great, so I don't have to worry about video compression. the pixels can be really quite perfect. But it's also scary because the piece, at its core is this simulation, and if you don't touch it for long enough, it kind of goes into a cinematic moment and then will come back out. And it's very much like I'm making the work for this format. And I have the idea that I'll turn it into a film, but there's always a possibility that like I'm confused and it won't be a good film. So I like to give a little break between making the like Genesis form and then what we saw tonight.
Yeah. give you some fresh eyes on it.
Oh, yeah. Decide if it's maybe not worth pursuing.
Well, before I open it up, I just wanted to ask you about, so I know that, was it the mess that you, because you did a project with Rhizome and the new museum, a VR project, right?
Yeah, so so the mess and pattern language, those are all, I would say, fragments of a constellation that I put under the umbrella of Aria End, which is a collaboration with the game designer and writer Porpentine. And the mess was the very first, the mess existed before the idea for Aria End existed. I got interested in exploring the mechanics of video games and kind of the industry behind it to make something, to make a film. And I, at the time, discovered Porpentine's work. She makes these kind of text-based interactive fictions. And so, yeah, I reached out to her, commissioned her to do some writing, and that kind of blossomed into this, you know, what has become Pattern Language, this new project called Dirt Scraper is also under that. And within that, the New York kind of internet art organization called Rhizome, that's affiliated with the new museum, commissioned us to make a VR piece. It's not truly a VR piece. It's a 360 video. They wanted people to be able to use it on their phone. So, yeah, I basically used that as an opportunity to pull fragments from the mess to make this something that, that I would want to be kind of like bathed in if I was stuck in my phone.
All right, cool. Okay, well, I think I'll open it up to any questions in the audience. Does anybody have any questions for Peter? Chris in the center.
I'm curious about the noseless figure and
the weird animal.
Yeah, it was. Well, it's such an. I mean, it's like a scarecrow who's escaped, and it's like many other things, and it's like a seed sower, and it's like a Palestinian sometimes because those moiré patterns make that scarf. But I just wonder if you could just talk about like whether that is a, you know, an avatar or a character that you love or what.
Yeah, I mean that. So special effect that similar to the way that pattern language was like a and to some extent Dirt Scraper, the project I'm working on now, were like these opportunities for me to try to teach myself a new tool. Special effect was very much like I was curious about 3D CGI, and for me it's often helpful to come up with a project to teach myself a thing, because otherwise it's just difficult. You can get so lost doing tutorials or whatever, like lost in the world of education or something like that, right? So I very much set out to learn this new tool. I used a product called Cinema 4D to animate those things, and also, I mean, a lot of different things. There's a program called Poser, which if anybody came to the program last night, we saw in the Le Carre's film. And I think with that film, I guess to give a shout out to her, she very much lays bare like what can be interesting about Poser, like those malfunctions, or some call it the uncanny valley that's really easy to slip into with 3D CGI stuff. But I guess, like, I mean, to talk more deeply about what special effect is, I mean, in part, it was like a response to maybe me doing too much Freudian therapy, but then also it was me, in a way, trying to honor what this film Stalker by Andrei Tarkovsky was about to me, but not in a way that was like overly reverent towards its formal aspects, because I don't make 35, 16 millimeter film. I come from a very different background. And in this way that, so Tarkovsky, to make that film, went into these kind of abandoned zones of exclusion, these industrial sites, to shoot this, essentially a translation of this pulpy science fiction story. I use that as an opportunity to explore. There's this area outside of New York, just a couple of hours, called the Borscht Belt. That's this like abandoned zone of resorts that not all of them are abandoned. If you guys have seen the film Dirty Dancing, that takes place in one of these resorts. But I went to a few of these different places and essentially just camped out in these abandoned zones, shot actual footage with the idea of putting these characters in there. And so, I mean, I guess in this way that I've talked a little bit about the way that I work formally, like responding to the material, I very much think that comes from like being a painter originally. Like you make a mark and the next mark responds to that. Those characters, I guess, kind of emerged out of that like kind of shit environment, that this abandoned, decayed environment, as well as this kind of shit software like Poser, and then bringing it into Cinema 4D. And there's actually some amazing stuff that Cinema 4D can do. intentionally, but then unintentionally. And so a lot of what I got interested in was doing these physics simulations and watching them kind of break apart. And so, yeah, in terms of like the nose being gone, it just felt like such a more interesting nose to have it be made out of hair. And then it could always be changing, but it's still kind of a nose, right? Sometimes it's droopy. And it just has a different expressive function. And so the clothes too, I mean, fragmenting. I was interested in the like alpha checkerboard pattern, just in terms of what that is symbolically, and the green of like a green screen, like these voids that I think as digital artists we get really used to. They're signifiers for voids. And so I was just thinking about different costumes to make out of that. And I was actually looking at some older like designs of like Russian theater costumes from like before Tarkovsky's time. And so that just blended together to make this kind of mess of a human, or these three humans that represent the different characters in Stalker and myself, if you want to get Freudian, but let's not.
Your avatar. Any other questions?
I was really interested in a sort of, I felt like there was a dialogue happening with a sort of visceral response of the viewer when the light kind of flashing and then a discomfort of the image through the sort of the moiré patterns and the way that it seemed to create a physicality of this digital immaterial sort of thing. And I was just wondering if maybe, yeah, you could talk a bit about that.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I guess, like, I already talked a little bit about, like, my interest in op art, and we don't have to talk about fine art back, like optical illusions, optical phenomena, where our bodies maybe malfunction to a certain degree, and we really notice the difference between the external world and the internal world, or, like, what our biology is made up of. I find that, like, boundary really interesting one to play with, and, I mean, I guess, in a way, I hope this doesn't sound pretentious, but in a way, like, I think a lot about how the computer screen or the projector, like the actual mechanics of these tools that are projecting the images, are these matrices, are these grids, and I'm not a doctor, or I haven't studied biology extensively, but my understanding of the way that like our own optics work is that there's some corollary in terms of like the, like how our eyes actually see what detects light and things like that, and the different, I mean, I guess the different kind of aberrations that happen. I find there just to be an interesting way to dance between like our own biological aberrations and then those of the projector, which is in part why I'm really excited about like moving to like using a game engine, so that those images are actually being drawn directly to the screen through the graphics processor. It's like there's this way that I get really excited about removing as much translation as possible, right? Because being a digital artist, it's like a way of working directly on the surface that's being projected. And I guess part of what's nice about being able to share this work here tonight is that the internet is just such a terrible way to look at a lot of this work because of contemporary compression codecs. It adds all this blur and fuzz that it kind of fucks up that visceral response that we get. I would have loved to have a better subwoofer if we could have had like transducers under all of your chairs, but like, so be it.
I've got a question there.
Sorry, dumb question. Was the music concurrently developed with it, or did one influence the other, or what?
Yeah, one influenced the other, and then the other influenced the one. I think each piece has a kind of a different workflow. But as I kind of mentioned in an earlier kind of point, the kind of back and forth of all the different elements that make up a piece of cinema or a piece of whatever to me are really interesting. And so, I mean, we can talk about pattern language again because that was the last one we saw. I generated a bunch of material, visual material, with my programmer, Mark, and had John come in every week to kind of look at what we were doing, to share, to respond. And a lot of the process when I'm working with John is we have shared reference points of music that other people are making. And he actually, he at the time was going on tour and still does with a composer and musician named John Gibson, who for a long time worked in the Philip Glass Ensemble. He's like an original member, but he composes some really interesting minimalist music of lots of different varieties. And there's a particular piece of music that John gravitated towards, showed to me. I responded really well to that. He in turn made this sketch just to kind of sketch out this idea. And that was in terms of the first half of the film, the arpeggiated part, I was like, this is it. Let's, and we, at that point we actually didn't change it that much. And so at that point I animated to the sound. And so it's really, I guess it's boring to talk about because it's kind of complicated and site specific, but yeah, it's not, it's very much not a super separated thing.
Anyone else? Any other questions? Oh, got one in the front over here.
Hold on a sec.
I'm just curious how much those things would work in real time as you use like game engines and stuff like that. Does that?
Yeah, so part of the reason I started working with Mark Fingerhut is that, I got a grant so I could hire somebody to like to do stuff that I'm bad at. Like, I'm not a programmer. Well, like in pattern language, we see this this very popular, famous algorithm called Conway's Game of Life that's played out. And in the mess, we see this algorithm called TenPrint that was a labyrinth generator that shipped with old Commodore. You know, I'm like interested in like code as an idea, but I think I'm maybe bad at it. I've just never kind of taken to it. And so when I hired Mark, the primary function was to work with someone who could build a shader. A shader is like it's a way of just having your graphics processor make it so you don't have to render stuff. And that for game engines, for real time, that's how we can have like a really sick first person shooter that looks really realistic. So when we get shot in the face, we get scared, right? So it's like using those strategies of the hardware. And he did a really great job. He you know, through a bit of trial and error, we figured out a way to it's essentially like a dithering algorithm, like a air diffusion dithering algorithm that we figured out how to more or less do real time. Yeah, so it actually renders pretty quickly.
But in the installations, do they run like, you know, from?
Yeah, so directly from the game engine. So this new piece that I'm making is just going to be a build of a game. So it's going to be a computer running a build of a game with pattern language, which is really the only other thing that we saw. The only thing that we saw that was built in a game engine that I actually did image sequence renders, because I guess it just made things easier. Like I'm coming from a filmmaking or video making background, so it just seemed, it reduced a lot of stress to like not force myself to be like a formal fascist about this. But like now that I'm more comfortable with the tools, and I've been working on this project for 9 months, so I've been able to kind of move into it slower, it's like it's working now actually.
Cool, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we have time for one last question. Anybody? I'm going to do that lecturer thing where I sit here for far too long just to see. Okay. Well, Peter, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much. Let's give Peter a round of applause.